Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942, written, I'm reading from Colonel Mansubu Suchi, the mastermind behind it all. And we're up to part 4, page 121, as I'm reading through, probably the 19th episode. And it's a pretty amazing thing, reading this as you develop the podcasting software and speak with people, and you're reading through and you go, hang on, the Japanese are attacking at night, Allied or the Indian and British soldiers can't fight at night, and there's this fear and panic, which sort of reminds me of what was inspired by the when the soldiers faced the Mongols a long time ago. This sort of disintegration of fear, so just a small attack, very attack which is sort of outside the mental framework of the people you're attacking. Like the attacks are so foolhardy and so extreme that it just has the magic effect of melting the enemy away. And so there's this interpretation of this effect, a weak, disorganized enemy, as a divine intervention. So any piece of good luck is reinterpreted as a divine stuff. And you, as we were reading through it, certain things up, you say, well, this account possibly is not entirely accurate. It's a sort of glossy account. Also, how's this person recording it? Is it their notes on it? And so I draw the conclusion that this major is actually, or colonel, sorry, colonel is writing from a the vantage point of having a community around him in Japan to help him with all the notes. He's either kept very good notes or someone is keeping notes for him. He's from a community. It's more like written from a group of people. I mean, it's him, it's very much by him, but the resource of him writing is a group of people. The also thing is that it comes out the importance of dates and the references, continual reference to a mythical time in Japan. And there's this time when the kamikaze wind blew and destroyed the Mongol fleet, which was about to descend and destroy Japan. Now, what that would have done is programmed the Japanese mind into divine intervention, the divine story, and that would have rebuilt it. And I suppose one of the things, I had the fortune of speaking with a Year 11 student, and he'd researched into this and pointed out the general, I think, I've forgotten the name of the, there's an American podcaster who's really fantastic, beautiful to listen to, but the general idea in that the army was not linked to the Japanese state, it was linked, the Japanese state was linked to the emperor, the army was linked to the emperor, and so the army can, is in a world of itself, it's not linked into to anything particularly good. So a lot of the, what you think of the stabilizing incidences of if you, I suppose another army gave orders for someone to do something illegal, they'd say, no way, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to break international law. But they do it without thinking, because there's this breaking up of the army goes to the emperor and not to the state. But I actually don't think necessarily any type of thinking which says, look, I'm part of a religion, I'm part of a political party, I'm part of a state, I'm part of the army, and then you make sure that your link is good to that organisation, and then you have to worry about whether that link is good elsewhere. Although it seems obviously something has gone wrong, so you've got the entire Japanese army invading Manila, Burma, Malaysia, extending down across the Pacific, bombing the Americans, all in the same couple of days. It's a pretty amazing thing to happen. But they're obviously programmed by an army who've got allegiance to the wishes of the emperor. But then when you actually see it, they've actually sidestepped the emperor. There's an assassination happening mentioned, and there's Mr. Tojo. So there's something happening in them. But the same sort of thing happens in a company. They're like, although we might say this is really bad and you should love the state. I think you'd say, well, was the state the British Empire? Is that necessary, the correct thing? We don't necessarily say that you have to swear allegiance to the Australian state, but you have to have abide by the rule of law and truthfulness. You have to assist the judge making decisions. So there's just so much more subtlety in the way that we've evolved now. And of course, these people haven't evolved. There's a whole lot of other societies which haven't evolved. And so what we're talking about is, do I have loyalty to a company or an organisation, a clan or a race? So before I get into the podcast, we've got this general idea of a whole group of people who are don't have access to the sort of different things they don't have access to. They don't have access to a broad information, learning about other cultures. They don't have access to social skills to help them improve. And they don't have access to a culture of learning about other cultures. So this is one thing that this particular group here. And they've also, say, if you've got a relatively short lifespan, so there's a whole lot of things that have changed now. The level of education, the greater lifespan, and the greater amount of education, I think, are major factors which say that you can't compare back then with now. I think now we've got another set of issues coming with us. Back then, you really had one shot at you. You were born, you liked the Japanese army. The Japanese army liked this, and you couldn't actually develop beyond here. But so it's not necessarily that now is a much more advanced time with a larger lifespan, greater communication, greater education, greater communication for it. Now we've got organized, subdiffuse. So some people of our society still believe in a religion, a race, a group, and stuff like that. And those people are being manipulated, well, are easily manipulated, or you might believe in a government department or something like that, something given down. And you can sort of pick sort of behaviour types from different types. So if you say, if you challenge someone's beliefs and they're in the government department, and why they do something, ask them to expand, and they're outside their comfort zone, they will regress to an older style of things. And you can sort of see this sort of stability here. So when going back when people had dissenting voices in the Japanese army, they just got sidelined. But when someone wanted to get a opinion up, if they could link their opinion to a mythical supernatural cause, like this commander survived and achieved supernatural heroic events. Now, of course, what happens is the people who do this and die get wiped out. You're only left with people, the only commanders left standing are the ones who've had this supernatural good luck with them. It's something which, if you're in a short time frame, a limited background, limited support, you're not going to question this over time. Before I get going, sort of the broad thing is that this Colonel Tsuji doesn't have actually a chance to actually podcast what he's doing, and that really has a sort of major effect. Being able to podcast, talk about things, and then talk with other people really means that you have a sort of deeper analysis. So his analysis is fairly, I suppose, Japan-centric. It's in a mindset of this divine wind, kamikaze wind, imperial law, and this comes across that when the soldiers are basically suicide troops. They when they go into battle, they go into battle to die, so they throw themselves across pillboxes to block up the pillbox, if they think they're losing the battle, they think, well, they should I kill myself for battle? And this is without question. So this sort of it would have been very interesting if you were actually not listening to me, an Aussie, trying to make sense of it now, but you're actually listening to the actual commander, and he would explain to you in a way that we or I simply cannot understand how you would want to get in Singapore for the Emperor's birthday. Bear in mind, Japan went from a feudal society in 1850. This is 70 years or 90 years, almost straight after they said, okay, we're going to modernize. And so they've sort of modernized by actually going overseas. They modeled themselves on the German army. They went and bought a few British ships and manufactured the designs and stuff like that. Not that we call it stealing designs, but they managed to actually just take in what for us would have been thousands of years of culture overnight. So what's done is it's built, but there's still basically a feudal warrior society, a few feudal warrior superstitious society underneath it, and in a society where life was not as sort of centrally important as we know it. People were willing to die very much. And I should say, this is part four, Dying Wishes of a Beloved Wife. Since the Russian-Japanese War, the Imperial Guards Division had no actual battle experience, and its fighting capacity was an unknown quantity. Yet the officers and men who received their baptism of shellfire in a fight at the crossing of Perak River were, where they unexpectedly routed the enemy of superior strength, exerted unusually good influence in the subsequent campaign. The road which extended to Ipoh from the Perak River was not completely destroyed, for the British were not given sufficient time to demolish it. Those in the lead of the Imperial Guards Division, after crushing the resistance of a small number of enemy left behind, took possession of Ipoh in the morning of the 26th of December and entered with a van of that unit. There was no street fighting, and one had the feeling of entering a quiet, undamaged country town. From the aerodromes which the enemy had occupied up to the previous day, our flying corps, under the command of Major General Endo, used bombs of gasoline, which were, as usual, left by the enemy, increasing its bombing attacks on the routed British columns. So Britain left the bombs and actually got bombed with its own bombs. On the evening of the 26th of December, a shrill air raid silence pierced our dreams. It was an enemy raid. Amid the reports of guns of our comrades who were shooting at random, the crash of bombs dropped by the enemy. In a twinkling of an eye, a peaceful street's Ipoh was seething, but there was not much damage. Evidently, the fighting spirit of the enemy air force had not yet degenerated. For the next military operation, this was a factor we had to ponder. As Kuala Lumpur was the capital of the city of the Federated Malay States, we expected the enemy to resist its capture with befitting obstinacy. While the staff was racking its brains to plan the leadership of the 5th Division and to find a way to use the Imperial Guards, a senior staff officer arrived. Quote, "Look here," he said, "how would you like to scatter from the air a manifesto of to the naive native rulers of Malaya asking for the cooperation of the people? Please have a draft proclamation drawn up by the commanding officer," end quote. At such a busy time, it was deplorable to dither about with such unnecessary trifling problems. Had there been any certainty that Malaya rulers' cooperation could be counted on, it would have been an excellent idea to draft such a manifesto. But there was no guarantee that any useful results would be achieved, and perhaps that was why the Major General would not write it. The obstruction of the work of an excessively busy staff by a simple-minded suggestion was not to be endured. The status of the Malay rulers was similar to that of the village headman. Even if we dropped the written masterpiece, with much reaction would there be? Propaganda might be desirable after we had conquered the British Army, but in the meantime I argued that it could not afford to send planes on such a futile mission. The senior staff officer, however, obstinately demanded the manifesto, saying, quote, "I think it is improper for the army commander's name, my name, will do. Please draw up a proclamation without fail." Quote, "Yes," I murmured. "If the name of His Excellency General Nishita appears, the local rulers will recognise it. But who will know your name?" This was a fairly severe slap in the face, and in a peacetime army I would have been punished for making such a remark. But amid the stress of the campaign, insults among officers were everyday affairs, and it was doubtful if I said it had any effect. Members of the staff showed no malice, but none of them felt any goodwill towards the senior officer who persisted in the trivial issue, while more important and urgent work of the battle was at hand. An English major who had been wounded in the chest at the Battle of Piggac River was picked up and carried into army headquarters. At the dispensary, he received courtesy medical attention from our army doctors. Oh, he's not going to survive, poor bastard. It is a fine thing that the enemy wounded should receive the same treatment as the wounded of one's own side. This was the policy of General Ishida. It was carried out. The English major was given cow's milk and soup, and which was, of course, came from Churchill's surprise, but it was too late. He was beyond help. Through the interpreter, who inquired what messages he wished to convey to his family, he said in tears, rolled down his face, comma, "Please tell my wife, who is a trained nurse in Singapore, that I'm happy to die as bravely as expected as a British soldier." And the address is, he had scarcely finished speaking, with his eyes closed, and he died. There was no difference in the human nature between one's own side and the enemy's side. We positively vowed to convey the message. After the capture of Singapore, we made inquiries, but it appeared the major's widow had already left in a boat which was afterwards sunk by the Japanese Navy. It's probable, therefore, she followed her husband. When I recalled that solemn fate, predestined from a previous life, and the promise that I never carried out because of the fortunes of war, the incident even now weighs on my mind. Oh my God, we've got another list. At Aipoa, thinking back over the military operations which had so far overwhelmed the north part of Malaya, and pondering the enemy's whole transport plan, I felt the existence of a contradiction which I was at a loss to understand. It was this. 1. If it was considered that the enemy would rely on Singapore Fortress and hold out there to the last man, then the military strength that had been poured to the north of Perak River was excessive. As the 3rd Army Corps, 9th and 11th Indian Division, retreated, fresh troops were successfully continuously moved northwards to reinforce the decisive battles of northern Malaya. 2. The enemy were increasing the strength of their field operations army and preparing fortified positions, yet the resistance lacked the sincerity and showed a reluctance to face a decisive battle with us. 3. Viewing the war from the standpoint of the British Empire at that time, it appeared that North Africa and the British Army was in the midst of a life-and-death struggle with Rommel's German army advancing on the Suez Canal. You can say that good old Aussies were at Tobruk. The defence of the Suez would have been considered to take precedence of the defence of Singapore, and it was accepted as a natural war principle that then, in Malaya, the British would have to conserve their forces. It appeared a mistake for them to exhaust successfully their military strength in an unprepared fighting zone of northern Malaya. Yet the excellent enemy main force which was thrown against us in first-class condition was, it seems, proceeding northwards from Singapore Fortress District. 4. Pouring in fresh reinforcements from the British Army's main strength to support the forces destroyed in the opening battles was like pouring water over thirsty soil. While this continued, there was a reasonable hope for our success. On one hand, it appeared the best to avoid hurried assault on Singapore Island and destroy the enemy outside the fortress first. On the other hand, it seemed essential to capture the stronghold before the reinforcements could arrive from Great Britain. Together, it was very difficult to form a well-reasoned judgment. You can imagine he's confused. The enemy conduct of the military operation was obviously a strategy of playing to the gallery. Quote, and it appeared that they had no consistent policy. Our original scheme, decided before the opening of the military operations, was to concentrate our whole strength on the prompt reduction of Singapore, and we agreed to adhere to this decision. For that reason, therefore, Kanoo Imperial Guard divisions concentrated around the environs of Opa, and the 5th Division pushed southward as fast as possible in order to give the enemy no time to develop new defensive positions. The British war strength was superior to that of the 5th Division, whose troops were exhausted, but preparations could be made to attack with fresh Imperial Guards divisions, which was better in condition than the 5th Division. The enemy having abandoned the Pratt River, the next point at which we anticipated resistance was the line between Gampa and Tanjong Malim. If the enemy intended to depend... Okay, darling. If the enemy intended to depend upon this important line, a serious decisive battle, we must annihilate them there, reinforcing the Imperial Guards immediately with the right wing of the 5th Division. It was decided to open the attack with the 5th Division, which would carry the fight to Kuala Lumpur, and then to alternate the 5th Division with the Imperial Guards to maintain the speed of the assault to the south.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.